Welcome to the Flourishing After Addiction podcast. I'm Carl Eric Fisher, an addiction psychiatrist, bioethicist, and person in recovery. In this podcast, I'm exploring addiction and recovery through deep dive interviews with all sorts of people working toward flourishing after addiction. Scientific researchers, artists and writers, clinicians, spiritual teachers, activists, people with lived experience, generally, people who are working on how to change and grow or helping others to do so. My goal is to learn from their experience and wisdom, and then to share lessons that are accessible and focused on flourishing and change. I believe addiction is one of the most rich and fascinating topics we can study, one with tremendous implications for all of human flourishing. If this sounds interesting to you, head over to my website. I have other resources and materials about addiction recovery. You can sign up for my newsletter, where I regularly send out information about books, research papers, policy developments I'm following, and more. If you sign up for my email newsletter, you'll also get a free guide I made about the many pathways to recovery. You can find all of that at carlericfisher.com. For today's episode, it's my great pleasure to be speaking with the distinguished, fascinating, wise psychiatrist and teacher I've known for a while, Dr. Jeffrey Guss. Jeff is a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and researcher with specializations in psychoanalytic therapy, addictions, and psychedelic therapy. And you can already hear from that introduction that Jeff sits almost uniquely at the crossroads of some fascinating developments that don't normally run together. I've known Jeff for years. I went to him years ago to try to understand psychoanalysis and addiction. When I was writing my book and asking around among the top people in the New York City addiction psychiatry community, all roads seemed to lead to him. And in the early stages of my research, he was enormously generous, sitting down with me and discussing the material, giving me more reading material, helping me to tease through some of the different perspectives on psychoanalysis and addiction. And as we discuss in this episode, it's actually a sad historical accident that the traditional old-fashioned sort of stereotype of Freudian psychoanalysis didn't actually deal well with addiction. But there are more modern perspectives that actually have something to add here. So not only does Jeff sits uniquely at this crossroads of psychoanalysis and addiction, he also has special expertise in psychotherapy and psychedelics, the focus of today's episode. He was the co-principal investigator and director of psychedelic therapy training for the NYU School of Medicine's famous study on psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy in the treatment of cancer-related existential distress. He has also worked as a study psychiatrist on studies of psilocybin-assisted treatment of major depressive disorder and MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. He's interested with the integration of these psychedelic therapies with true high-quality contemporary psychoanalytic theory. And as we'll also discuss, he has an interest in gender, sexuality, and the way psychoanalysis relates to culture and society. So there's a lot to unpack here. But the main focus is psychedelics. And he was one of the earliest pioneers of these NYU psilocybin studies, which I think many of you will be familiar with. But for those who are not, let me give you a brief background. So a little more than half a decade ago, this work was published and then made famous first by Michael Pollan's 2015 New Yorker article on the trip treatment. And then, of course, his book, How to Change Your Mind. And in those journalistic accounts, we hear researchers talking about how individuals transcend their primary identification with their bodies. They experience ego-free states, and then they're able to return with a new perspective and profound acceptance on their impending death because of cancer. People who had been palpably scared of death totally lost their fear. And the way that they did this was they administered psilocybin as part of monitored therapy. Participants would meet for preparation sessions with therapists like Jeff. They would go to a room in the hospital that was decorated to look more like a living room than a medical office, in a comfy couch and paintings on the wall and even books of art and mythology and Buddhas and glazed ceramic mushrooms, as Pollan describes it. And so when the psilocybin was combined with psychological counseling, the research found that the treatment protocol significantly reduced the distress of cancer patients for months at a time. And the relief lasted for more than 6 months in 80% of the 29 study subjects monitored. And so Jeff was involved in all of this. And that's why I asked him on this show to talk about his specializations in psychotherapy, addictions, and psychedelics. We talk about so many great topics on this episode, but in a way, the main focus is to zoom out and get a bird's eye perspective on how it is exactly psychedelic psychotherapy might be a paradigm shift. This is the term that people use over and over again, paradigm shift. In thinking about it in these terms, psychedelic psychotherapy, I think, becomes a way of getting perspective on some of our current paradigms, like 12-step recovery, like psychotherapy in general, like addiction treatment in general. We can ask questions about what are these treatments even meant to do and what needs to change, even for people who are not particularly interested in going through psychedelic psychotherapy themselves. We talk about the neuroscience of psychotherapy and the neuroscience of psychedelics, thinking beyond a chemical imbalance discussion or a broken brain discussion of addiction to the spiritual and existential dimensions of treatment, the mystical experiences regarding psychedelics and otherwise, and what those experiences are supposed to actually be doing for addiction treatment, cautions against over-medicalization, but also cautions against putting the mystical experience up on a pedestal, and Jeff's practical thoughts on thinking through who might be appropriate and who might not be appropriate for psychedelic psychotherapy for addiction or otherwise, including really important cautions and who it is not right for. And ultimately cautions about Michael Pollan, who, as he acknowledges, he respects quite a bit and doesn't take issue with much of his work. But there is a Harry Met Sally issue where people point to Michael Pollan and say, I'll have what he had. And it just doesn't always work that way. So Jeff is a really energetic, earnest, fun guy with true love for his topics. I think this is a rich and information-packed episode, and I hope you enjoy. All right, I'm here with Jeffrey Guss. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm really looking forward to it. And I always like to start with the personal. We have a lot of great clinical and psychological material to cover. But just to begin, so people have a sense of you and where you're coming from, I thought I'd ask about your own experiences. So to start, because we're talking about psychedelics today, is there anything you'd like to share, anything you'd be willing to share about how psychedelics have touched your own life?
I often answer this question, Carl, by telling the story of what happened in 1967. 1967, I was 14 years old, living in Louisville, Kentucky. My parents subscribed to Look magazine and Life magazine, and we also got the news. And during the summer, an issue of Life magazine came to us saying, LSD on college campuses, LSD, the new mind medicine. When I read those articles and saw those pictures, I knew then this was going to be part of my life. I don't really know how I knew that, but I knew in my belly that my life was going to be involved with psychedelics in some way. Unfortunately, 1970 came when I was a senior in high school. The Controlled Substances Act of 1970 was passed, completing what had been nearly a decades-long progression of increasing restriction on psychedelic research and psychedelic movement towards availability in the United States. And so from my point of view, psychedelics went completely out of my life and out of the world for almost 30 years. It wasn't until 1999 that there was a conference at NYU on ibogaine, the medical anthropology of ibogaine, that was put on by Ken Halper. And it was at that meeting that I was standing in the lobby waiting to go back in and talking to people. And I saw a group of people that were standing together, and I went and joined them. And it turned out that they were a number of practitioners who work with ayahuasca, which is a South American brew that has strong visionary and psychedelic properties. So I became friends with them and expressed my interest in having an experience with that. They invited me in, and it was then that I had my first real encounter with an actual psychedelic. So it was many, many years between the awakening of my curiosity and my first experience with it. Although before that, I did become aware of Andrew Weil and his book, A Natural Mind, which is one of the first books to really talk about altered states of consciousness in a non-judgmental way, in a way that really emphasized their potential for creativity and expansion of the individual rather than as an escape or a way to get away from life itself. So that's how I became involved with psychedelics. I became a therapist. I became a psychiatrist in kind of the traditional, nice Jewish boy way. My parents were troubled. My family was neurotic. And I became the family therapist, or at least I thought I was. And I got into the process of listening carefully to people and finding that was something that meant a lot to me. And so that brought me to medical school and psychiatry, and after that into specializing in addictive disorders and psychotherapy. And after about 15 years into my training, I completed psychoanalytic training at the NYU postdoctoral program, psychotherapy and psychoanalysis. And it wasn't. It was in 2005 that I graduated from my psychoanalytic training. It wasn't long after that that I became involved with the NYU project using psilocybin-assisted therapy for cancer-related existential anxiety. And that study began in 2008, and we finished that study in 2013 and published a paper about it in 2014. And that's really how I became a part of the what's called the psychedelic renaissance, and then I was part of that study. A similar study was done at Johns Hopkins University. We had almost the same protocol, and so those two papers came out and showed psychedelic-assisted therapy, or particularly psilocybin-assisted therapy, for cancer-related existential distress can be both safe and helpful. So we had really promising results, and the safety profile was very good. It's called a phase two study, meaning it was a relatively small N. We had 29 people who completed our study. But as you may know, a phase two study is not large enough to bring about rescheduling. So a much larger study is currently in the works, but I was part of that initial phase two study and was the director of psychedelic therapy training for the therapists that were in our. So it was then that I first conducted psychedelic therapy with patients and at the same time became a teacher of psychedelic therapy to the therapists that were in our research project.
Great. Yeah. And it's that expertise in psychotherapy that made me want to talk to you, especially because I'm really curious about this notion of psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy as opposed to other ways we might be able to deliver psychedelics and how they're being used and how they're being advertised. But first, just to pause on one point of your biography, you mentioned that you are not just a psychiatrist or a psychotherapist. You went through the quite rigorous process of becoming a psychoanalyst. And you did that after a little ways after your initial training. So can you say more about that for people who, you know, might not be familiar with, say, like the NYU Psychoanalytic Center? And why do psychoanalysis? What was that about for you?
I'd be happy to talk about that. You know, my psychiatric training was a total of 4 years. The first year was an internship, so it was mostly medicine and other non-psychiatric endeavors. So I had a little more than 3 years of training in psychiatry. So there's so much to learn in psychiatry that psychotherapy is only a part of the many, many ways that psychiatry is involved with medicine and in psychotherapy. But I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I was very, very interested in the psychoanalysts and the psychoanalytic approach. But I didn't pursue psychoanalytic training in Ann Arbor, Michigan, because my concern was that the Michigan Psychoanalytic Institute had an essentially homophobic philosophical, psychological, and practical construction in it. So I didn't feel comfortable in applying or entering training at that time. In 1991, I moved to New York City. And as you may know, in New York, there are 10 or maybe 15 different psychoanalytic institutes to choose from. And the one that was the most interest to me, the one that was the most interest to me, is NYU postdoctoral program, partly because of its truly eclectic teaching philosophy, and also it's many of the writers about gender and sexuality that I had come to admire and thought were so smart were teachers there. So I started my training there in 1999 and finished in 2005. So my analytic training and my private exposure to psychedelics had an overlap. But that was a period of time when they were quite separate. The work that I did with ayahuasca was quite separate, and a lot of it happened in South America. That was really different than the work I did in addiction treatment and running an inpatient and then an outpatient use disorder program here in New York City. It was in 2005 that, with my friend and colleague Alex Belzer, we went to a psychedelics conference in Basel, Switzerland. It was the 100th birthday of Albert Hofmann, whom you may know is the chemist that developed or that invented, synthesized LSD. It was his 100th birthday. And it was at that conference that I met Charlie Grobe and many, many other researchers and other kinds of professionals and enthusiasts and shamans and guides of all kinds. And I became, I'm so awakened to the breadth of interest that there was in the world in psychedelics of all kinds. And in fact, that there was an overlap between psychedelic use and academic psychiatry. And it was the confluence of those that led to, starting in 2006, a psychedelic reading group with Steve Ross and Tony Bossas. And not long after we started this reading group, we switched to a research group and began the study that I told you about using psilocybin-assisted therapy for cancer-related existential distress.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in terms of addiction, as you've mentioned, that you had this interest in psychoanalysis. In particular, it sounds like writings on gender and sexuality within NYU specifically were really interesting. And then you also had this, it sounds like, parallel interest in addiction. So can you say a little more about what drew you to the treatment of addiction?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I didn't realize it at the time, but there was addiction in my family growing up, which I really came only to understand as part of my therapy a number of years later. But really how I got involved in addiction is during my residency training program, I was on a team that had psychologist, psychiatrist, social worker leading it. And the social worker that was on my team was an addiction specialist, Terry Donovan. And I had an addictions case and he supervised me. The patient got better quickly. And there was like a natural affinity for me in working with patients with addiction. I understood what drew them to substances and what they found valuable in them. And I understood how to talk with them about their ambivalence, about continuing versus stopping. And much addiction is a kind of conversion. In the old days, it was more of a conversion model where you went from being a sot, alcoholic, lush to a reborn AA big book thumper. And that kind of conversion model was not the approach that my supervisor took. My supervisor, even before it was really written about, took more of a motivational interviewing, harm reduction approach that helped in a collaborative way work with the patient and understand their defenses, understand the compensatory value of the substance in their life, and working with the transference to help them come sober, stabilize sobriety, and cope with long-term sobriety. So all of those are deeply psychodynamic processes, even though some of the technique is different than what you do in a psychoanalysis or in a psychotherapy. The way of understanding what's happening inside the patient and inside the room and inside the relationship between the two of you, all of that was deeply, embedded in psychodynamic processing. So I became a psychodynamically oriented therapist early on in my training, and I used that kind of approach in the addiction work that I did. So I did that in private practice in Ann Arbor, and then when I moved to New York in 91, I ran an outpatient alcoholism program at the New York Hospital in Westchester Division in White Plains, and then I came to Bellevue, and I ran the inpatient dual diagnosis unit, and it was there that I met Steve Ross and Tony Bossas. And in 1995, when I left Bellevue, and I went into private practice. That was, not long after that I became interested in working with psychedelics as well. That became part of my life.
Great. It's such a rare combination to have someone who is psychologically, psychodynamically trained and oriented, who is also interested in addiction. I think it's such a sad, maybe historical accident in a way, maybe, that large portions of the field of psychoanalysis seem to consider addiction as if it's not an appropriate subject for treatment. But I personally, as a clinician and also as somebody in recovery, have gotten a lot out of what I consider to be a more sophisticated and modern psychodynamic views on addiction and just about general technique.
One of the reasons for that, Carl, is that the permissive openness towards substance use that is embedded in the traditional old-fashioned psychoanalytic model led to people believing that they were involved in an active treatment when their analyst wasn't saying anything about their substance use, but was only interpreting underlying dynamics. And the problem with interpreting underlying dynamics for somebody who's actively using is that the affect and the conflict isn't really available for work. That's what the addiction does, right? The addiction takes the most unbearable, unmanageable, unknowable, frightening affects and relational configurations and pushes them underground. So you could talk about them, but you can't really feel them. And talking about them doesn't accomplish anything. Or if anything, it just stirs up more, which leads to more need to self-medicate. So understanding the ambivalence of the active user and this exquisite balance between stopping and what that could lead to and continuing and what that could lead to came very naturally to as part of a psychoanalytic model in which you are talking about what's going on, but not either forbidding it or ignoring it, which I think is an old-fashioned psychoanalytic model. I mean, it used to be some analysts thought that people with addictive disorders were untreatable. That is, that they could not be treated using the psychoanalytic method. And the truth is that psychoanalytic method needed to be developed, needed to be changed, needed to be brought into a better understanding of behavioral and neuroscience aspects of addiction. Because if you do study psychodynamic and behavioral and neuroscience, you have a much better way to understand what's going on with the person that you're trying to treat.
Great. Very well said. I mean, that's why I wanted to talk to you, is to speak with somebody who has a real sense of depth and nuance around psychotherapeutic technique. And that perhaps leads us to the question of psychedelic psychotherapy. So you've used this term psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. And to start off with a relatively broad question, I wanted to ask what makes it psychotherapy and what's different about psychedelic assisted psychotherapy versus, say, for example, the casual model that most people have of someone taking a psychedelic and having a guide or just someone there for general support or safety, and or just the substance somehow magically doing the work on its own. In other words, what is the psychotherapy doing and why make it psychotherapy at all?
Great question. I'd like to start my answer to that question by saying I believe that there are many, many settings in which people can use psychedelics in a creative, life-affirming, valuable manner that have nothing to do with psychotherapy. I believe that if somebody chooses to go to a rave and take MDMA or take psilocybin mushrooms and dance and have a tribal experience, listening to the music and listening to it build and build and leading to a massive climax in a room of 500 people at 2:30 a.m., that is a brilliant, important, valuable, useful experience that I respect. I think that people using psychedelics in a religious context, such as the Santo Daime, where the goal is spiritual development and religious awakening, is another setting in which I believe that psychedelics are valuable. Santo Daime is another setting in which I believe that there is a valid use of psychedelics that has nothing to do with therapy or therapists. I also believe that in many cases, taking psychedelics alone or in a group of friends is another valid way to use them. It's just that the intention and the purpose is different, and therefore what you get out of it is quite different in those different settings. I'm going to give you a somewhat tautological answer to your question, in that psychedelic therapy is something that is done by therapists. In my opinion, if it's not done by therapists, it's not psychedelic therapy. It's maybe something very valuable, but it's not psychedelic therapy. And I believe that there is a place for psychedelic use that is done by a sitter, by a facilitator, by a guide. But those are more passive and somewhat less engaged in their relationship to the process at hand. And those are valid things to do, but in the randomized clinical trial work that I've been a part of, the patients who are admitted to the study are organized according to their psychiatrically defined diagnoses. So you can't get into a study at NYU or any other major university for personal growth spiritual development, or recreational fun, or problem solving. You are admitted to those studies because you have a DSM-5 or ICD-10 defined psychiatric disorder, major depressive disorder, alcohol use disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, anorexia. One of the problems in our study was the cancer anxiety study is that we had as our identified problem existential distress, which is a very real thing. And there's lots of to be read about it in the palliative care literature, but it is not a DSM-5 diagnosis. So we had to switch from existential distress to defining our goal or defining the problem as anxiety and depression. So we moved from existential distress to anxiety and depression, the goal being to show a reduction in anxiety and depression in our patients. So again, we had to medicalize the whole conception of it. I also believe that that patients who have psychiatric diagnoses are particularly vulnerable to very, very complicated relationships to psychedelic use. By that, I mean, often they have to come off medication in order to be in the study. So whatever the medication might have been doing for them, they're apart from that. And symptom reduction and improvement in functioning are what we're looking for. They are the goals that are set out. And I believe that psychotherapy can be very helpful at shaping the psychedelic experience. And in return, psychedelics can be very helpful in shaping the psychotherapy. So it's my belief that psychedelic-assisted therapy is the long-sought-for union of talk therapy and medication therapy. In psychoanalysis, there is a long history of skepticism about the changes that happen in patients as a result of medication. It's seen as a Band-Aid covering up the real problem. It's seen as an easy way or a fast way. And it's seen as a false solution to a real problem by people outside the field. Now, many people within the field think that it goes right to the heart of the matter, which is a broken brain, which needs to be fixed. Chemical imbalance. And I feel that the idea that psychiatric problems are a chemical imbalance is what I like to call an impoverished narrative. It's not a wrong narrative, but it is impoverished in that it misses so much of what the nature of human suffering, psychiatric problems really is, because of course there are psychological, sociological, and spiritual components to depression and anxiety and so forth. And to reduce it to a brain imbalance, I think puts a spotlight on something that needs a floodlight. I think much more needs to be illuminated than the idea that we're correcting the chemical imbalance. On the other hand, there is an extraordinary power that can come from medications and their effect upon the brain. And psychedelics in particular bring about a number of changes in the way that the brain functions at a biochemical and physiological level, especially in the way that large groups of neurons work together to generate consciousness, to generate perception, to generate identity and a sense of identity, and memory. So all of these are profoundly affected by psychedelics, and I believe that it is the therapist's guide to use this state, which is in some ways an unruly, disruptive state of the brain, to use it in ways that connect the intentions, the experience, and the follow-up. So I, as a relational psychoanalyst or a psychoanalyst that trained at a relational school, am particularly attuned to how relationships work, attachment patterns, anxious attachment, avoidant attachment patterns, and so forth. So I begin making a relationship with my patient and observe how they attach to me. I hear about their relationships. And then in their journeys, I pay particularly close attention to what happens in their relationship themselves, with other people, with the medicine, spirituality, with national concern, with global concerns, and so forth. And then the integration, again, is relational in its nature. I'm not saying that that's the best way, but that is my way, because you know, becoming a relationally oriented psychoanalyst was what seemed natural and right and fitting for me. If I had been steeped in Jungian psychology, I might listen for the emergence of archetypes and the collective unconscious. And you could find those in a psychedelic journey too. The psychedelic journey is a place of unrestrained cognition, that is, associations are much freer, and a sense of identity that constricts us into a narrative identity, also known as our defenses or our ego defenses or personality structure, those transiently are softened or more than softened. Maybe they might even be said to melt for a period of time, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. And then as the medicine wears off, things can come together again, hopefully in a new way. One of the things that so often happens in psychedelic work is a decrease in self-defensiveness, that is, being able to acknowledge the truth about yourself more clearly, tolerating seeing unconscious processes. Psychedelics manifest unconscious processes, affective, cognitive, and memory processes and perception.
Great. Let me ask you a question. I just have to interrupt here because I think that's really an interesting overview of relational dynamics. And I was wondering if we could ground that in a specific example of addiction treatment. It sounds to me like you're saying that people develop all sorts of ideas and assumptions and models for how we work in relation to each other. And one of the things that psychedelics can do is soften that. And then you work with that in psychotherapy. So can you talk a little bit more about, say, what a therapist might be doing as opposed to, say, a shaman or a neo-shaman or whatever else other healer might be doing in the case of people with substance use problems?
So what I'm going to speak about, Carl, is the work that I did in the NYU psilocybin-assisted therapy for alcohol use disorder randomized clinical trial research. And the PI of this study is Michael Bogenschutz. I think that the earlier, smaller study is completed, and they're working on developing, again, a larger phase 3 trial. And I'd like to draw your attention to, I'd like to draw the attention of your audience to two important parts of that, as far as I was concerned in that study. I'm going to start with the more general one, not the more general one. I'm going to start with the more specific one from the study, and that was something called a values sorting exercise. In part of the preparation for the study, we would give patients a stack of cards that had 60 or 80 values, and they were asked to sort them into least important, kind of not important, medium important, important, and most important. Then you would take away all the first four categories and work with the most important stack. And then you would divide that stack, ask them to just divide it into the same categories. And when you had five of the most important values for that person, you would ask them how their substance use affected those values in their life. And what you would always hear is that their substance use led them to compromise their values, to forget their values, to engage in a simulacrum or a fake of their values, and they saw the loss of integrity, identity, self-respect that their addictive use caused for them. So we would do that before the medicine session. So they would know that we were going to be talking about values. Now, it doesn't matter what your values are. I mean, if your value is to be pretty and to be sexually attractive to other people, then that's your value. And if your value is patriotism and, you know, respecting the flag, then that's your value. If your value is altruism or helping other people or, you know, being intellectually curious and so forth, it doesn't really matter what the value is, as long as it really means something to you. And so then, under the influence of the medicine, they would have a deeper, more emotionally truthful, more emotionally powerful sort of meditation, or maybe even a marination on this question of, who am I? What does my life mean? Where am I going? How have I gotten off track? what's wrong with my life as a result of my alcohol use? So there was definitely a focus toward how values changed as a result of alcohol use. Although we didn't demand people talk about that, they almost always did because we prepared them for it. Another aspect of this is true for me, and I think other therapists in the study too, is relationships. Most people have good relationships as a value of theirs. And that means different things for different people. But I would encourage them to talk about their family, talk about their loved ones, friends, relationship to hobbies and work. All of these relationships were of interest to me, much more interest than what happened when I was four or what happened to me, like trauma from the past. So we did not go so much in that direction. And then under the influence of the psilocybin or the psilocybin-assisted therapy, people would have very deep emotions about relationships that were important to them. And of course, we would explore how alcohol, or well, in this case, alcohol, because it was an alcohol study, how alcohol had brought about a loss in their life, or how alcohol had facilitated that on the other, in some other way, was causing problems. I mean, some people find alcohol helps them make love or talk to other people, but their liver is, you know, very ill, or they can't stop and they say things that are, so there's like pluses and minuses. So these two qualities, values and relationships, under the influence of psychedelic session, were very deeply felt. People became less defensive, more honest with themselves and others, and they became deeply convinced that at this point, shifting towards abstinence and perhaps recovery was the right direction for them, and also a direction in which they were capable of changing. So as you may know, it takes two things for somebody with an addictive disorder to change. They have to believe that they need to change, and they have to believe that they can. So some people have one or the other. They believe, oh, I can change, but I don't need to. And other people believe, I need to change, but I can't. So it was our experience that the psychedelic experience helped people feel very deeply the need to change, but also they had an increased sense of self-efficacy or self-agency, an increased sense of self-efficacy or self-agency, which is really just a kind of a behavioral way of saying, I can do it. I can do it. So believing I can do it because I'm receiving help is an essential part for many people to change. Many people change on their own from an addictive use disorder, but many people find they need help. And AA is a very powerful, transformative system for those who can accept it, for those who can relate to it, for those who have an affinity for the language in it. It is a life transformative process. And as you may know, only the first and the last step of the 12 steps have anything to do with substances. The second through the 11th are about admitting that you needed help from other people, acknowledging your character shortcomings and problems, turning to other people for help, letting help in, turning to a higher power for help in changing, becoming ready. First, you become aware of your character defects, then you humbly ask for help in changing them. I mean, these are the central part of the AA process, and you see them in psychedelic therapy, but it is the medicine and the context in which the medicine is being given that has the external power that then comes in. So the idea that you need help from the outside and you take it in, there's really a parallel between psychedelic-assisted therapy and 12-step work. You know, you don't get better in 12-step work by yourself, right? It's not a self-help program. It is a other help program. It is a peer program. You get better from the group. You get better from a higher power. You get better from the big book. You get better from meetings. You get better from going out for cheeseburgers afterwards. You know, all of these external processes that you take in help facilitate change. And the same is true in psychedelic assisted therapy. You get this very special kind of moment where options and hope and imagination get big. And then you have a therapist to help you take that experience and turn it into a way of life. without the preparation and the integration afterwards, it has a higher risk of becoming a marvelous experience filled with insight, filled with wonder, that then closes down and becomes a memory, like a trip to Cancun for a week. You can't believe how relaxed you feel and how great you feel, and the sun feels so good. But then when you go home, you have nothing to take with you except for a memory of what you don't have.
Jeff, let me ask you about that, because that's really a lovely and grounded description of the process. Mm-hmm. And I say grounded because I think there's often a sort of lofty discourse around psychedelics, and people get very attached to the notion of ego dissolution or transformative change. And you're talking about this more in the register of people helping each other and values, and I think more tangible things. So what about those more lofty spiritual sounding notions? Like, maybe we can start with ego dissolution. How does that play into the whole process? What does that mean?
Well, I got a lot to say about that. I have a lot to say about that, girl. The psychedelic experience can vary enormously depending on the setting, the person taking the drug, the context that they're in, and the dose. The lowest doses bring about an aesthetic effect of senses being heightened, perception being a little altered, colors seeming more vivid, sounds seeming more vivid and rich, touch of skin feeling a lot better. So there's like a sensual aesthetic level. The next level is a psychological one, in which memories of the past, relationships in the present, daydreams about the future, trauma, affect, and so forth are very much present. And that is the psychodynamic level of psychedelic intoxication. At a higher dose, and with certain people who can let go of their narrative identity, you know, relatively easily, you can enter a mystical state. And sometimes just increasing the dose more and more brings people into a mystical state. The mystical state is what happens when the narrative identity is taken offline. The narrative identity is who you think you are. The self that is your personality, your place in the world. You're a doctor, you're a son, you're a father, you're a sculptor, you're a smart guy. All of these attributes that we have that make us unique, that tell us who we are, so that when we wake up in the morning, we remember our name and our clothes are familiar to us and we do work. All of this is part of our narrative identity. This is not the entire sum and substance of who we are as human beings. In fact, our narrative identity exists in order to screen out a great deal of information from the outside world and from the inside world. That's the purpose of our narrative identity, also known as our ego, also known as our personality, and so forth, so that we come pretty much ready to interact with the outside world and the inside world from a familiar place. Most of the things that we happen in the world, we imagine that they are there. We imagine that they are there because we have predicted that they're going to happen. And many of the things that we do, we bring up day after day after day because they allow us to be in this unbelievably complicated world and only see the things that seem to matter to us and not see the things that upset us the most and see things that help us the most. So we are discerning creatures. We decide at an unconscious level what we want to pay attention to and what we want to ignore. And what we want to pay attention to and what we want to ignore is a function of our ego. It's a function of our personality. It's a function of our narrative identity. And in a number of ways that I could describe using neuropsychoanalytic language, I won't do that right now. We psychedelics are capable of taking that part of the brain, sometimes known as a default mode network, taking it offline. A colleague of mine, a friend, Larry Fishman, has written a paper, Seeing Without the Self, the description of the neuropsychoanalysis of psychedelics. So if you take away your personality, your tastes, your defenses, but you are conscious, alert, paying attention, and have memory, then who are you? What are you? What is the experience of being a self with a capital S rather than a self with a small s? The small s self is your unique personality. The capital self is who you are when that small part of you is quieted down. That state is synonymous with the mystical experience, a profound sense of alteration of space and time, a deeply felt sacred sense feeling, and so forth. These qualities that define the mystical experience. Well, it may not surprise you to discover that the more elements of a mystical experience that a person had, the more complete their mystical experience, the greater the relief of the symptoms that they came into the randomized clinical trial for study of. So a hypothesis was put forward that it is the mystical experience that is the most therapeutic for depression, anxiety, alcohol use disorder, and so forth. So the intensity and the vividness of the experience, and in particular, the amount of its completeness of mystical experience, is correlated with symptomatic improvement. So this left out the more traditional model of understanding narrative, understanding your history, where you came from, how you came to be who you are, which is the purview of psychotherapy, right? And psychoanalytic work, understanding transformation through understanding and refining and changing these narratives, finding new narratives. And so for that, and because a lot of randomized clinical trials are very short-term and do not involve longer-term therapy, the model of the mystical experience, a single one or two transformative experiences leading to change, became favored. That and a number of other factors have contributed to the traditional psychotherapeutic approach being somewhat sidelined in contemporary psychedelic research. That's one reason that contemporary randomized clinical trial research uses terms like facilitator or guide rather than therapist, because they did not want to conflate a psychotherapy process and a psychedelic process. However, you may not be surprised to learn that in the 1950s and 1960s, there was an enormous amount of psychoanalytic psychedelic therapy that was done by psychoanalysts who were sent vials of LSD by Sandoz for use with patients. I mean, this was all, it was neither legal nor illegal. It was unregulated. It was unscheduled. There were no laws against it, and there were no laws for it. It was just like the stuff that came from Europe to America, and psychoanalysts discovered all of these amazing effects, mostly to the psychoanalyst involving the deepening of abreaction or emotional involvement, psychological life review, like looking at yourself and really being honest with yourself about who you were, who you want to be, your relationship with your therapist, your transference and countertransference, and so on. So these were psychoanalytic treatments that were facilitated by LSD, usually. Sometimes there were other psychedelics that were used, but that was the main one. So we have this history that's largely been erased from American psychoanalysis, and it's only grudgingly remembered in American psychedelic discourse as well. And it's an area that I'm particularly interested in. I am not trying to say that I think that the psychoanalytic or psychotherapeutic approach to psychedelics therapy is the best one or the most important one, but I do think that it is a very valid one. And it's an area that I'm particularly interested in because I think that psychoanalysts would be exquisitely talented at being psychedelic therapists. I think that psychoanalysts are involved with understanding the unconscious and a transformative process born out of evoking unconscious process in the room with you through the transference. And that is exactly what happens with psychedelic experience. So I believe that these two disciplines or these two discourses in the States and in Europe of psychoanalysis and psychedelics that have to some degree kept apart in the Renaissance, psychedelic Renaissance, need to be brought together again in order to complete our approach, which is both mystical and neuroscience-based. There's a lot of interest in neuroscience aspects of psychedelics, as well as the mystical state. So I think we need to complete with the third part, the psychodynamic part.
Yeah, I think it's very compelling and really useful. So thank you for that. One thing that's coming to mind is that you have some useful cautions, as I'm hearing it. You know, you've delivered a caution against medicalization in the form of a sort of broken brain model of psychiatric dysfunction. also a caution against the notion of medicalization as a disorder-based idea of human problems, that reducing it to a psychiatric diagnosis.
I think that's problematic for psychedelics.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. It serves a function, of course.
I don't think it's a problem in researching schizophrenia medicines. I just think it's a problem with psychedelics because I don't think that seeing them as bullets against a disease understands the nature of them very well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. No, that's what I mean. It's a good clarification.
It's a fundamental shortage.
Right. Right. And likewise, I don't think that psychiatric diagnoses are intrinsically good or bad, but they serve a function. And sometimes we overlook the context-dependent issues involved with them. They're serving a different function if you're using a diagnosis for insurance reimbursement versus somebody's personal identity versus guiding certain types of treatments versus other types of treatments. And it's good to be clear about that sort of utilitarian notion of the role of a disorder diagnosis. But so here's another caution that I'm hearing from you, is that you're cautioning against reifying the mystical experience as if it's the sole mechanism of action or is the most important thing going on. And it strikes me that one reason that might be attractive, including to commercial entities and for-profit companies, is because it's easier to scale if you have a quote-unquote guide or facilitator as opposed to a psychotherapist.
I want to intervene and say one thing. It's easier also with a mystical state to imagine one or two or three dosing sessions, mm-hmm. one and done, or two or three and done. The psychedelic psychotherapy that was done in the 50s and 60s was that people would receive dozens, if not hundreds, of doses. They would be in a hospital, they would receive psychotherapy, they'd have an analytic session with their analyst three times a week. They would receive, say, 20 micrograms of LSD three times a week for a couple of weeks, then 30, then 40, then 50. So they had many experiences in learning how to introduce the egolytic effects of LSD into their ongoing treatment. So in that case, the medicine was an adjunct to the psychoanalysis. The contemporary model, the guide or facilitator is an adjunct to the psychedelic. Therapy helps the drug experience, is the contemporary model. And the other model is that the medicine helps the process. And one of the things that I think is going to be an enormous impact in the century ahead, I hope, is that we will find treatments that are somewhat successful in psychiatry that are more successful when some psychedelic is added to it. Because the defenses, the rigidity, the resistance is softened. So an existing therapy can become more effective. And as we all know, anybody that's practiced psychotherapy knows that our methods meet with an end to their effectiveness. You know, you can work with somebody for 5 years and they've changed a certain amount. But you know, if you work with them for 10, they may not change that much more. And that's because you enter into a kind of repetitive, ritualized thing where the therapist and the patient are like in a steady state. And I believe that a psychedelic intervention might really deepen and transform the effectiveness of that approach. So I think psychedelics can help existing therapeutic approaches in addition to offering something of their own.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you have other concerns about commercialization? This is such a hot field. There's so much money going into psychedelics right now. I had just offered the suggestion that maybe commercialization drives the move away from, or maybe the neglect of psychotherapy in some circles. What is your take? Just in general, as somebody who's steeped in the field and knows a lot about psychedelics, do you have other concerns about commercialization, or how do you look at all the money in this space?
There are a lot of answers to that question. The ones that seem most relevant to me or the most urgent in my way of thinking about things is that somehow there seems to be this idea that we need a fantastically large number of psychedelic therapists fantastically fast, like it's some kind of like emergency. Like we need to train a zillion people quickly. And I don't believe you can become a good psychedelic therapist quickly. I don't think it can happen in a year of some very intense weekends. It can't happen in, you know, 6 months. It takes a long time to become a seasoned therapist. It takes a lot of sitting with troubled people to learn not just who they are, but who you are in relation to their troubles. And the method, that's the third in the room. There's the troubled person, there's you, and then there's the method that you're bringing in, which is part of the culture that all of you are in. It takes a long time to learn how to do that. And the techniques of how to keep your mouth shut and ask open-ended questions, that can be easily learned. That's something that's a skill set that's not hard to master, but that's a caricature of a therapist. That's not a therapist. And I believe that, if you look at shamanic cultures around the world and throughout history, many shamans begin their training early in life. Some of them are called into shamanic training from childhood as a result of a serious illness or trauma or loss of a parent or a number of things that make a child sensitive. And someone who's marked for being sensitive to the spirit world may be invited into shamanic training, will spend many years as an apprentice, as a low-level apprentice and a mid-level apprentice, and then gradually becoming a full-fledged shaman once they are affirmed by the community in which they are living, right? So you don't become a shaman and just decide yourself that you are one. You show yourself to the community, and the community says, yes, we embrace you and embrace what you do. In the same way that it took us 8 years to become doctors. And there's all kinds of social structures that said, yes, you made it through college. Yes, you made it through medical school. Yes, you made it through residency. And the culture has said, we think doctors help. We affirm what doctors do. You are a doctor, and the federal government, state government says you are a doctor, and we value the doctorly approach to problems. And that's the way shamanism works. Shamans are not fringe characters. They may live on the fringe of town, and they may only work with people at the edges of consciousness, but the culture that they're in affirms them, and they take many years to learn how to do what they do, which is enter the spirit world and act as an ambassador or a negotiator with the spirit world. And if you think about it, that's kind of similar to what psychoanalysts learn to do. Although our spirits are generally internal, object relations, but also many analysts are now thinking very much about how politics affect the psyche and the cultural determinants that affect who we are. Freud was not interested in this. Freud was completely an intrapsychic model. He wanted to have an idea of a world in which all people were the same, and the purpose of culture was gratifying needs. That's what the mother was. You had a need, the mother gratified it. And so the outside world was important as the need gratified, as opposed to really taking in the culture. We now know just how deeply Freud's culture affected his supposedly universal theories of how the psyche worked. But that's another talk.
That's a really rich topic. It's good, though.
We're not going to go in that direction. So getting back to your question, I believe that rapid training is somehow a demand of commercialization. And I think that it's a problem.
I can imagine somebody listening to this podcast and asking themselves, how do I know that one of these offerings is legitimate, or that I won't be exploited, or that there's sufficient oversight, or that they even know what they're doing? Like, what advice would you give to somebody in that situation?
Gather information, talk to friends, start low and go slow. Trust your instincts and your intuition about the person you're working with. You know, what you're describing is a very real concern about public responsibility of psychedelic practitioners. You know, we don't have any way of guaranteeing the prevention of sexual exploitation by psychoanalysts, psychotherapists, yoga teachers, meditation teachers, college teachers. So we have all of these examples where power differential invites abuse. And this is true in psychedelic work as well. It's not uniquely a problem in psychedelic therapy, although there recently has been a big expose about this. It's an inevitable occurrence when you have large groups of people who are doing something that brings us to the very edge of taboo behaviors. And the ecstatic state of psychedelic intoxication is an edge behavior and an edge in which certain boundaries on behavior are loosened. And it takes an exquisite amount of ethical concern. It takes a lot of careful thought and ethical consideration to do this work using the most scrupulous ethical principles imaginable, because the invitations to transgress boundaries are there. And each practitioner needs to know who he or she or they really are in order to practice in a manner that doesn't harm anyone. The psychedelic state brings about a state of dependency, suggestibility, and trust, as does psychotherapy. And not all practitioners are trustworthy, even though they all should be. So that is something to watch out for and to be careful for and to remain vigilant, that sexual experiences with a psychedelic guide are, with a psychedelic therapist, are always inappropriate. If you are tripping with your buddy or your girlfriend or your boyfriend, that's a different matter. That's a peer. That's somebody who is your equal. And the boundaries on behavior are quite different there. So this, I think, is a really important part of training. And it's much more complicated than simply saying to the trainee, don't do it. Don't do it. And that's a good place to start, but it's not a sufficient place to end in working with sexual transgressions. Another very important point that I'd like to make here, Carl, is that many, many people in our modern culture of late modernity take psychiatric medications for a broad variety of troubles. We are in the psychedelic world, a little bit of a black and white era where allopathic medications, SSRIs, SNRIs, antipsychotics, and benzos are seen as poisons from corporations. And that although they may seem to help problems, they actually are damaging and harmful. Band-aids that cover over the problem, that cause more problems than they're worth, and so forth and so on, while things that grow in the earth, like psilocybin mushrooms or ayahuasca, are safe, holy, and all good. So you have this dichotomy of good and bad, which leads some people who have been in psychiatric treatment for a long time, or for a short amount of time, who are on medication, to come off their medication. And it isn't just coming off the medication, it's also the underlying condition that may get revealed, that may reoccur. And some people in those conditions should not take psychedelics. They're already have overactive kind of psychological associations, and psychedelics may make them worse. They're not right for everyone. And I think it takes discretion, talent, and knowledge as a practitioner to say, yes, I think that a low dose of psilocybin would work for you, or yes, I think you should take a large dose of ayahuasca, or no, I don't think you should do that. I think you should go to somatic experiencing therapy and develop an exercise regimen. I don't think psychedelics are for you. And I think that you have to have some intelligent basis on which to make that determination. They don't help everybody with everything. And some people, including some psychedelic practitioners, believe that they are always of value to everyone. And that's just not the case. So I think coming off medication to go on psychedelics is a risky thing to do. And ignoring other traditional treatments is something that I caution people, practitioners included, to not advise for somebody you don't know very well. It gives me great concern when I hear a non-medical practitioner advising somebody on tapering their medication so they could take a psychedelic.
Yeah, that is medical practice.
It's medical practice, and it's easy. It's easy. Just take less. It's easy to tell somebody to do that, but it's not a safe thing to do if you don't really understand that person's history, their relationship to the medicine, psychiatry that they're in, and also their level of functioning in the world. So when I talk about tapering medication, it's not just the medicine. It's the condition that the person had that led them to be receiving that medication in the first place. That needs to be included in a good care.
Yeah. Really important cautions, Jeff. Really, really helpful stuff. I think, honestly, we've only scratched the surface. I think less than 10% of my notes and the materials I reviewed. And I could talk to you about this all day, but I want to be respectful of your time and the listener's time. Before we go, I wanted to ask if you had any parting thoughts, words of wisdom, burning topics that we didn't get to that we really must cover today, or any call to the listener, any place you want to send the listener, call their attention to.
You know, a great place to learn about psychedelics is Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind. He offers a broad range of informational gambits for the curious, sophisticated reader. However, I can't tell you how many people have come to me and said, I read Michael Pollan's book, and like when Harry met Sally, I'll have what he had. They want to have the exact same experience that Michael Pollan had. And of course, nobody could have the same experience that Michael Pollan had. Only he had the unique set of intellectual, affective, social factors that led him to have his experience and access to all those people and all the money to go all those places. And somebody who was high functioning to begin with. I mean, all of those things went into his personal experience. And you cannot guarantee that for you. But I think that his book is a good book for a general introduction to the world of psychedelics.
I couldn't agree more. I've seen that phenomenon myself. It's the pollen replication effect, maybe we could call it. People who go read it on a weekend and say, I'll have what he's having.
And I love him. He's a lovely, lovely person.
Jeff, we're going to have to wrap up here, but it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Where can people go to learn more about you or learn more about your work? Any other aspect of your work that you want to talk about?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Right now, I have reduced my involvement with NYU, and my involvement there is really limited to being a study therapist in a couple of studies that are still underway. Most of my time now is spent with an organization named Fluence, F-L-U-E-N-C-E, and Fluence is devoted to education in psychedelic therapy integration. Psychedelic integration therapy. That means that we specialize in helping people prepare for and make decisions about psychedelic work, and also integrating experiences that they may have had. I want to distinguish this from a setting which actually teaches people to give psychedelics. The only context in which Fluence is teaching people to give psychedelics is as part of decriminalization initiative in Oregon, and we are going to be training, among many others, people in that state who are going to be giving psychedelic materials to patients. So at Fluence, I teach in a number of different courses. Most of them are about integrating psychedelics and psychoanalysis, but I've also taught on fundamentals and basics of psychedelic therapy. And I do a consultation group where we talk about clinical cases, a lot of which involve ketamine. As you may know, ketamine is a legally prescribable medicine, and there are some similarities between a certain level of ketamine intoxication and psychedelic experience. It's not an exact overlap with the serotonergic psychedelics, but there are a lot of similarities. And so we work with people who are doing ketamine-assisted therapy and teach people how to do that and provide a clinical consultation group to help people talk about clinical work that they're doing.
Great. Great resource. And if I'm correct, it's for professionals and practitioners.
That is right. That is correct.
Great. Well, Jeffrey Gus, I was attracted to your work and really helped a great deal by meeting you much earlier in my training. And I just want to say thank you for giving me a crucial orientation to some of the depth psychology and psychotherapy around addiction. It's been tremendously helpful for me. So it's just really wonderful to meet you again and to hear about this work and all of your important education and cautions on the cutting edge of this topic. So thanks so much for coming on. I really enjoyed our conversation.
You're most welcome.
That's my episode with Jeff Gus. I hope you enjoyed it. Just a few things I want to highlight and amplify here at the end. First, I loved Jeff's discussion of relationships and attachment and how what happens in the therapy room and what happens in the psychedelic psychotherapy room is profoundly important It's not just about getting the compound into the body, but there's something that happens there in the relationship and the integration. For example, clarifying values. This notion of values, which I think is so important and in some ways under-discussed in psychotherapy, not about moralizing or putting one's value system on the client, but thinking about what truly matters in the moment, what somebody is working toward, what their vision for their life is. And also on integration, I think it's so important that Jeff talked about how it's necessary to take this experience and turn it into something that changes your life. That there's a risk of, without integration, experiences like these can become just a memory, like a nice vacation. This is an important theme for all of treatment. There's a similar issue with rehabs. There's a similar issue just in personal development with meditation retreats or other kinds of retreats. And so in all of these cases, it's important to think about how we integrate these experiences for ongoing change across all of our life dimensions. Not just how do I go get a nice experience, but how do I work with it and carry it forward? Jeff also mentioned the neuropsychoanalysis of psychedelics, including some papers such as Larry Fishman, Seeing Without the Self. These are great resources, and I'll definitely link to those in my show notes. I also wanted to note that Jeff talked about his work with a company called Fluence and his work as a psychedelic psychotherapy trainer. And just so you know, that's not sponsored. I have no commercial relationship with Fluence. I actually didn't even know of his work with that company when I reached out to him. So just so you know, there's not a conflict of interest there. I asked Jeff because I wanted Jeff, and then this happened to be part of the discussion. And then finally, Jeff mentioned an expose about sexual abuse. And I think this is really important to highlight because among all the risks we discussed related to psychedelic psychotherapy, one is sexual abuse and exploitation. And there are things that make people in psychedelic psychotherapy perhaps uniquely vulnerable to sexual abuse and exploitation. For one thing, there's the fact that people are put into an altered state. And then there's also the fact that it's largely unregulated. It can be hard for people to access these therapies. And so a notion of desperation or a lack of care and consideration might creep in. So the expose that Jeff mentioned was reported by Vox Media Podcast Network and New York Magazine, picked up by the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Basically, two Vancouver therapists that were part of the MAPS Clinical Trials Network in Canada acted really inappropriately during the treatment of a distressed PTSD patient during an MDMA trial. These two therapists, one of which was unlicensed, during the therapy session were cuddling, spooning, blindfolding, even pinning down a distressed patient. And this is a person with a past history of sexual abuse and assault. And there's more to the story than that. MAPS found that they substantially deviated from the study protocol. There were significant problems with their internal review. They only looked at the video 6 years afterward. So this story is an important cautionary tale about this push that Jeff highlighted to train a lot of therapists very quickly. It's just not something you can rush, that you should rush. So I will put more information about those reports as well as the other topics discussed in the show notes over at carlericfisher.com. There you can also sign up for my email list and you'll immediately get a free guide I made about the many pathways to recovery. And you'll also stay up to date with the latest episodes, show notes, and other writings. Once again, you can find all of that at carlericfisher.com. If you're finding this podcast useful, I'd really appreciate it if you help me get the word out. The best way is send this episode to just one other person you think would be interested in it or you think would benefit too. You can also subscribe on your podcast player, leave a rating, and a nice review. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It isn't medical or clinical advice. This content is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. If you have questions, please consult a medical professional. Conflicts of interest are an important topic in addiction and recovery. For now, these podcasts are just me bringing these conversations to you ad-free for their own sake. I do have a list of disclosures about my work and positions on my website, which I will keep updated.